This is The Guardian.
Regid Ahmed here on Gadigal land with the full story.
We have suffered an almighty blow here from which I fear we will never recover.
I've got family who are Holocaust survivors, and it reminds us of those times.
It really is surreal to imagine that this could happen in Bondi.
It's been more than 24 hours after a terror attack at Bondi Beach, and a clearer picture has been emerging.
I divulged this morning that they are both a father and a son. The father has held a firearms licence since 2015.
As we speak, 16 people have been confirmed dead, including one of the alleged gunmen. And authorities are warning the death toll could still rise. Scores are being treated in hospital, some in a critical condition. And alongside the grief and shock, the political reaction has been gathering pace. On gun laws,
the government is prepared to take whatever action is necessary. Included in that is the need for tougher gun laws.
And anti-Semitism.
We've seen a clear failure to keep Jewish Australians safe.
Today, senior reporter Ben Doherty on the unfolding aftermath of the Bondi Beach terror attack. It's Monday, the 15th of December. Hi, Ben. Thank you for joining us again. We spoke this morning, and now that the aftermath is continuing to unfold, it's good to have you back on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Regid.
You've been back out to the scene. People have been laying flowers. Give us a sense of what it's like there now.
People are returning to Bondi. They're coming back to the beach. Things are not normal. There are huge sections of Bondi Beach which are still cordoned off and that can't be got to. There is a lot of work for the emergency services and police to work through. But people are returning. You go out on the streets in Bondi and people are walking down towards the beach carrying flowers. A memorial has sprung up, has been established at the back of Bondi Pavilion, near to where the shooting took place, and people are going there to commune, to spend time with each other, to lay flowers and to remember those who were slain. It feels like Bondi is trying to find its way back and to trying to understand how it's ever going to reconcile itself to what has occurred here. At the north end of Bondi Beach, where I was just recently, someone or a number of people have taken all of the items that were left on the beach in the panic of the shooting and neatly rearranged them on the concrete at the edge of the sand. So it's people's shoes, it's hats, it's umbrellas and sports balls and kids' spades, the quotidian items that people would have at the day of the beach that they just simply abandoned in the panic.
It's now late Monday afternoon. The attack was on Sunday, and we're starting to learn more about the victims and who they were. Can you take us through some of the details we've been getting?
Thanks, Commissioner. Thanks a lot for being here this afternoon.
So 15 people were killed by the two gunmen.
Having spoken to Jewish community leaders today, they're reeling and in crisis, and obviously many of them are incredibly distressed at what they've seen. The latest information is 15 innocent people are dead.
We know of the 15 people, one was a 10-year-old girl named Matilda. Alexander Kleitman was an elderly man, a Holocaust survivor, who also died. A 41-year-old rabbi, Eli Schlanger, was a father of five. He became a father for the fifth time. His youngest child was just born in October.
Flags will fly at half-mast across the country today, as we pay our respects to all those lost and all those who have been injured. And we conclude by saying that yesterday was indeed a dark day in our nation's history, but we as a nation are stronger than the cowards who did this.
Not everyone who's died has yet to be formally identified, but police understand that their ages range between 10 and 87 years old.
And we're learning more about some of the injured.
This is still moving, but we understand that 42 people were taken to hospital or presented themselves to hospital, and there are 27 people who are still there, still being treated. Five of those are in critical condition. Two people in hospital currently are police officers who suffered gunshot wounds. They are believed to be in stable conditions.
And one of the things we've been hearing about today is the man who was filmed confronting one of the alleged shooters. Some more details have come out about him as well.
This is one of the things that has emerged from this awful incident in the midst of this extraordinarily cruel violence. Some incredible acts of bravery and supreme courage. Ahmed El Ahmed is a fruit vendor from the south of Sydney. He used the cover of a car. He was entirely unarmed. He used the cover of a car to creep up on one of the gunmen, and he lunged at the gunman, lunging at his neck and his arms, and he disarmed him, took his rifle off him, and then pointed at the gunman, who was sort of forced to retreat. It was an extraordinary act of bravery. We know that Ahmed El Ahmed was subsequently injured. He had 2 bullet wounds, 1 in his arm and 1 in his hand. And he was praised by the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, on Monday afternoon, who said he acted at great risk to himself and suffered serious injury as a result of that.
So we've heard about the victims and the injured. On the other side is the police investigation into the alleged perpetrators. And I know there still isn't a motive and more details are coming out, but we have learnt more about who these men were.
We are slowly learning more about these attackers. They are a father and a son. They are from Sydney, from Bonnyrigg in Sydney. It is believed they were using legally obtained firearms. The father, Sajid Akram, was licensed to possess 6 firearms, and police say that they believe it's some of those 6 weapons that were used in this attack. His son, Naveed Akram, is 24. He was arrested at the scene. He is critically injured. He's in hospital in a critical condition under police guard. Sajid Akram, the 50-year-old father, was killed at the scene by police. He was shot by police. Now, we're learning that the son was known to police and to security agencies, but we don't know very much detail. We don't know a great deal of detail about exactly what brought him to the attention of authorities in 2019. He came to the attention of ASIO around his association with others, but ASIO found that there was no indication of an ongoing threat or a threat of him engaging in violence. We don't know, as you say, the precise motive for this, but we do know that this was an anti-Semitic attack. This was an attack at Jewish Australians. This was a deliberate attack on Jewish people celebrating a Jewish festival of Hanukkah at the beach. We saw in videos that have been circulated, we saw that Naveed Akram at points waves at other people, people who are yelling at him. He waves at them but doesn't fire upon them to then turn his weapon again on the Jewish community.
And I'm not sure how much we can say about the weapons that these men allegedly had and what it might have suggested about their intentions, but police have found explosive devices.
That's right. They were explosive devices, crude explosive devices in police terms, found at the scene in the car of the attackers, drove to the scene. A lot of this information is coming in piecemeal, and there's obviously a great deal of desire to know as much as possible about this attack, what motivated it, why it's happened. But police are sort of working quite steadily and slowly through this. They have reported that they have raided a house in Bonnyrigg. They've raided another Airbnb property in Campsie where the two men had been staying. Police are saying again that Sajid Akram was a member of a gun club and he held a gun license. He was licensed to own these weapons.
While police are continuing to investigate and more details are coming out, there's definitely a political side to this that's come out today. And one of those clear issues is gun laws. Both the New South Wales Premier and the Prime Minister are indicating that they might re-examine them. Why would they be talking about that?
I think this is in the memories of a lot of Australians, was the 1996 Port Arthur massacre in which 35 people were killed. And following that, there was a suite of gun controls brought in, particularly around semi-automatic and automatic weapons. About 650,000 weapons were compulsorily bought back by the government. It feels like Australia is having another reckoning now around gun control and another national discussion about where controls need to be put in place so that these sorts of events aren't able to so easily take place, that someone can legally own a weapon with which they can do so much destruction and so much damage and cause so much trauma.
The government is prepared to take whatever action is necessary. Included in that is the need for tougher gun laws.
Anthony Albanese said he'd like to look at limiting the number of guns that an individual can hold under a licence and to review people's licences over time. He says licences shouldn't be in perpetuity, that people's views change, people can become radicalised, people's situations change, and what was once safe might not now be safe.
If we need to toughen these up, if there's anything we can do, I'm certainly up for it, and I hope to get National Cabinet on board for that.
The New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, has also said that gun laws need to change and they can change, but he hasn't really indicated what that will be. Gun control and gun laws are the domain of the states, but it does feel like this is a moment akin to 1996 where there will be a national conversation about the way Australia wants to approach these weapons.
The Prime Minister did mention John Howard's laws when he was talking about reassessing. How do you reflect on this moment coming full circle?
I think we're almost 30 years since the Port Arthur massacre, and I think the world is a different place and the world has changed. And I think, to Anthony Albanese's point, these things shouldn't just be set in stone. This should be an ongoing national conversation. Certainly the Howard laws, when they were brought in, were seen in some quarters as particularly controversial, and it was, you know, even within John Howard's own party, that this was a difficult thing for him to pass. But I think over time, Australians have realised that these have been extraordinarily beneficial laws to Australia, in that we have rates of gun violence that are significantly lower, hugely lower than other countries where gun controls are much more lax. But I think what was once seen as the gold standard again needs to be examined, you know, and potentially needs to be reformed. These things aren't set and forget.
The other issue that has really come out today, even from last night, is around this examination of anti-Semitism. And it's something that Susan Lee has really criticised the government over in the aftermath of this attack.
The opposition leader says there's been a failure to protect Jewish Australians, and there's a palpable anger in the community, or almost a bewilderment at the lack of protection. She says it's been a clear failure to keep Jewish Australians safe. Susan Lay said that she's spoken to Australia's anti-Semitism envoy, Julian Siegel, who has been urging the government to respond to her report around anti-Semitism in Australia and respond more rapidly and respond more forcefully. We have seen a number of anti-Semitism incidents across the country, places of Jewish worship, at Jewish cafes, and we know as well that some of these haven't been domestically motivated but have been inspired by the Revolutionary Guards of Iran. This is a global issue, anti-Semitism, and a rising tide of anti-Semitism. And certainly this is something that the government is coming under significant pressure to act upon.
I know the Prime Minister has responded and said that some of Gillian Siegel's recommendations have been implemented, but he's not just getting it from there. He's also come under real pressure from the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu.
Benjamin Netanyahu was very forceful in his comments. He said Australia had done nothing to stop the spread of anti-Semitism. You know, he described it, you know, as a cancer that was growing inside Australia, and that the Australian government took no action. Anthony Albanese hasn't responded directly to this.
At the best of times, what we see is Australians coming together.
Anthony Albanese instead, in response, said this is a moment for national unity.
And what I want is for Australians to come together, and that is critical. There is no place in Australia for anti-Semitism, and people who were exercising their right to express their faith through Hanukkah had every right to expect that they could do that in peace and with a joyful celebration, which is what it's aimed at. Thank you very much.
Certainly the Prime Minister seems very focused on the domestic response at the moment, but there's been a huge global reaction. This has been on many front pages around the world, and we're also seeing a few other countries just make a few security changes in response.
I think so. Hanukkah is obviously a Jewish festival that is celebrated by Jewish communities around the world, and I think almost all of those celebrations have now been coloured and marked by this tragic event. In Australia, we've seen condolences and support from world leaders all over the world. And as you mentioned, Regid, security measures increased for the Jewish community. Hundreds of police are being sent to Jewish community events around Australia and elsewhere in New Zealand. The FBI director, Kash Patel, in the US says he's been in touch with security agencies in Australia regarding this horrific attack, and that the US were providing assistance. Certainly there is a global response to this attack.
And back home, there's a real outpouring of sympathy and solidarity. I've noticed a lot of comments throughout the day from different Muslim community leaders.
That's right. Australia also has a special envoy to combat Islamophobia, Aftab Malik, And he's condemned the Bondi attack, saying there is no justification for this sickening violence or the hatred against anybody. And a Muslim leader, Sheikh Adam Ismail, was approached in 2019 by Naveed Akram, who sought lessons on Quran citation and Arabic language classes. Ismail said this. He said he was deeply saddened by what had occurred and offered his condolences to the victims and to the Jewish community. I condemn these acts of violence without any hesitation. He said, what I find deeply ironic is that the very Quran he's learning to recite clearly states that taking one innocent life is like killing all of humanity. This makes it clear what unfolded yesterday at Bondi is completely forbidden in Islam. Not everyone who recites the Quran understands it or lives by its teachings, and sadly, this appears to be the case here.
The aftermath of this will continue to unfold. I'm sure we'll get more details. But where could we see this go next?
This is going to be a long recovery and a long reconciliation for the community here in Bondi, for Australia's Jewish community. There is a lot of healing that needs to be done, and this is a deeply traumatised and damaged community. This is not a matter of days or weeks or months or years. This will be a scar in this community for a very long time. The New South Wales Premier has mentioned plans for a memorial. We don't have more details on that. The federal government has talked about a rapid processing of visas for family members coming from overseas for funerals or and assistance for the cost of those funerals. So there are these machinations in place. One of the things that's been asked of people, and the Prime Minister and others have mentioned this, is to put a candle in the window.
Light a candle, put it in their front window tonight at 6:47 p.m.
Bart Steinman, who's from the Jewish Council of Australia, has asked that every person to light a candle in memorandum for the dead and for their loved ones.
Show that light will indeed defeat darkness, part of what Hanukkah celebrates, of course. We are stronger than the cowards who did this.
Ben, thank you so much for keeping us across a really difficult story today and keeping us updated. We appreciate it.
Thanks for your time, Richard.
That was senior reporter Ben Doherty. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert and Camilla Hannan, who also did the sound design and mixing. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. I'm Regid Ahmed. See you soon.